Thanks so much, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to an NAESP audience. I've really enjoyed your conferences in the past and look forward to seeing you all, I hope, in person. But we'll make best use of this medium, the webinar for today, to talk about equity and excellence and focusing on what matters most. As Honor said, the chat box is available to you, so please use that anytime to ask questions. Don't wait for the end. Just interrupt anytime, and you can use the chat function, and that way I'll be able to respond to you immediately. And we've got people literally from coast to coast, from Virginia, right in the middle of the country in Derby, Kansas. And I actually know where Derby is because I've been there. Not very many people might be able to say that, as well as in the West. So thank you for taking time to join us. I want to make sure that we make this relevant to you. So you'll see at the opening slide there, not only my Twitter handle, but that's really my phone number, and you can reach me by text. I respond to teachers and administrators from all over the world every day. So please don't think it's an imposition. Part of our commitment is not just the information in this webinar, but also after this webinar is done, the opportunity to correspond with you as well. So let's take a look at the next slide. What I want to try to address is some new research and then also talk about short-term wins. There's a couple of new books that Honor was kind enough to mention. One is The 100-Day Leader. I think we spend way too much time perseverating about five-year plans, not nearly enough time saying, what can I do in 100 days, in the short term, to really make a difference for students? And then I'm going to talk about equity and excellence. Some of you know my work on the 90-90-90 schools, that is 90% poverty, 90% minority enrollment, 90% of those students meeting or exceeding state standards. A lot of people have got the first two 90s down, the third 90 is pretty darn tough. Well, this new book called Achieving Equity and Excellence is a synthesis of all of that research that extends way beyond my 90-90-90 studies and includes many other researchers and scholars to whom I'm deeply indebted for their contributions to this field. And what I want you to take away from today is not necessarily big changes in policy, but your willingness to do an experiment. Hey, this what Doug says about nonfiction writing kind of makes sense. Let's try that for 100 days. What he said about collaborative scoring, hey, we're not ready to change policy yet, but we'll try it as an experiment. And then you'll judge for yourself whether or not it works. So let's get to work. Next slide. What I want to try to do is, first of all, offer you some free stuff. At creativeleadership.net, you'll see free videos, free articles, a lot of tools for both teacher observation. Many of you who are current or aspiring administrators will find that useful. There's also a leadership assessment tool. These are all free downloads. So go to creativeleadership.net. You'll find them. And if you want to subscribe to the blog, you'll get new research in your inbox every single week. If many of you are working on your doctoral dissertation, please go to finishthedissertation.org. It is free. It is non-commercial. And all we do is help students finish their doctoral degree. We started that group literally in a church basement 6 years ago because of the alarming statistic that 69% of doctoral candidates never finish. What a waste of money and time away from your families and just energy. We want to help change that statistic. And now we have students literally on six continents all over the world. So if you or a loved one, a family member, are working on your dissertation, go to finishthedissertation.org for free and non-commercial help. Now, some of you have finished that, and now you're working on the next book, somebody that more than your mom and a committee chairman will read. So we started this new writers group called marshwriters.org. It's available both if you're in the Boston area live, but also by a video conference first Saturday of every month between 10 and noon Eastern time. And we help people write their first book, their first article, again, free and non-commercial. So let's get to work. Next slide. What I want to do is remember it's okay to call me. I realize not everybody has video. And so I put my phone number up there. So if instead of using the chat function on webinar text, you wanted to text me a question instead, you're certainly free to do that. That's the number. And if you need me to read it, I will. 781-710-9633. That's 781-710-9633. And the respectful request I want to make for you is not just have your own questions, but think about the people who are not here. Maybe teachers or parents or even students who voices we need to consider as well. So feel free to speak for them as well. Next slide. Now, what I want to do is give you the latest in 2020 research. I always start presentations here, so I'll get to what I promised, but give me about 5 minutes to give you some pretty interesting research updates. Next slide. Decreasing failures in 100 days. This came from a very high second language district, about 90% of kids not speaking English at home. They used to have a a system where they had huge amounts of failure, 70, 80, 90% of kids at these schools failing. And here's what they did. They maintained their traditional ABCDF system, but they stopped using the average. You want a big idea to take away from today, get rid of the average and have grades reflect whatever grade you're talking about, elementary, middle, I don't care what it is. The grade ought to reflect how they finish the semester, not the average. Don't be punishing kids in May for the mistakes they're making now in January. So they got rid of the average. They got rid of the 100-point scale. The 100-point scale is just an anachronism. We don't need that anymore. You can just have plain old A, B, C, D, F systems. And they had a dramatic, as you can see, reduction in D's and F's. And friends, they stopped grading homework. I'll say more about homework in a minute, but that also is an anachronism. A home is where a lot of things happen, but homework oftentimes isn't one of them. And when we insist on grading homework, we're more likely to be grading parents than we are students. They also had improved discipline, culture, and focus on learning. What the teachers told me was this. When we made these small changes, getting rid of the average, getting rid of the 100-point scale, then the conversations were no longer about points. They were about learning. Next slide, please. Now, how does grading reform help not just struggling students, but what about high-achieving students? In one of the schools, the different ones, when every time they were able to eliminate a section of repeaters, and you see it all the time, particularly in grades 7 and 8 that some of you are serving, and even in grades beyond that, tons of money and time lost repeating English, repeating math, repeating science. When they had fewer D's and F's, they had more electives, more music, more art. Kids really loved it. The high-achieving kids also had more meaning because an A wasn't just about point accumulation, but really mirroring their need for learning, and it was closer to the college experience. College used to be sitting alone in a lecture hall of 800 kids, sink or swim kid, you know, that's what you have to do. College today is significantly different, and it's about actual demonstrations of learning, getting feedback, responding to the feedback that the professor offers, and this grading reform really helps your high-achieving kids and your struggling kids. Next slide. Now, I want you to know, I don't know if we have anybody from Australia or not, but if you put one finger on the map in Derby, Kansas, and another finger on Tasmania, which is an island south of Australia, it'd be harder to get farther away from Derby. And yet, what's on the front page of the Hobart Tasmania Mercury? Homework and grading. It's everywhere I go. I could be 100 miles away from working electricity and running water and still find people arguing about homework and grades. So let's get to the next slide. You know, you can read that one for yourself. Too many kids are waiting for autocorrect instead of actually getting the work done. Next slide. So what does the evidence say about homework and practice? I'm indebted to Alexandria Neeson for the definitive study on this. I ask people, why do we assign homework? Well, we assign homework because kids need practice. I'm all for it. So the only question is, what's the right kind of practice? Ask your athletic coaches if they send somebody home with a football in their backpack instructed to do the odd number of defense problems, 1 through 30. I'll bet they don't. And whether it's the marching band or your football team, they know what good practice is. Good practice has coaching. Good practice has feedback. Good practice has differentiation. That's gold standard practice. And you never see that at home. So when people say, I assign homework because kids need practice, great. Let's have a conversation about what great practice is with coaching and feedback and differentiation. It's not what's happening at home right now. In-class practice promotes honest conversations. Now, I know it would never happen in your schools, but you know what's happening in other schools? Kids are getting the homework answers on the internet from siblings, from all kinds of places where they can crib it. And here's what happens. When they walk into class the next day with their perfect homework, they can't have an honest conversation about what they don't know. And so actually doing the homework in class, that's where practice happens. That's where coaching and feedback and differentiation can happen, in class. And then we can have honest conversations about what we do and do not know. And we certainly don't grade practice. Finally, Alexandria Neeson's study, not just one study, a synthesis of 37 studies says the impact of homework K-6 is zero, zip, nada. If it were up to me, it would be in the bylaws of NAESP that elementary schools can't assign homework because it doesn't help, and all it creates is giant inequities. The impact, even if you teach in upper grades, 7 through 12, is minimal. Next slide. So here, go ahead and skip this one. I'm going to go on to the next one to save time. Depression and anxiety. Stuff that we used to only see in high schools, we're now seeing in middle and elementary schools. In fact, in this New York Times report from last year, our adolescents and early adolescents are saying that depression, stress, anxiety is a bigger issue than bullying, drug addiction, all kinds of other things that they see. And we've got to be attentive to it. And frankly, we're not staffing our schools with the social workers and counselors that they need. It's a serious issue. Next slide, please. Now, a lot of you, even at the elementary level, get asked what colleges need. What are, you know, this is the pushback I always get on homework issues and everything else. Well, is this going to help my kids get ready for college? As a matter of fact, it will. Here's, in a study that I did, what college professors are saying they need. Number one, they need students who can take and seek feedback. When you have students who can't take feedback, because if you gave them honest feedback, the next thing you'll have is an angry call from a parent or maybe the parent's lawyer. Teachers wind up being reluctant to do it. In college, they got to take and seek critical feedback. They got to advocate for themselves and ask for help. Too many kids get the message that the good kid doesn't need to ask for help. Yes, they do. All of our kids need to ask for help. Another big takeaway from this afternoon, nonfiction writing. If there's any big, robust research finding, it's the following. Students who do more nonfiction writing wind up having dramatically better results, not just in composition, but in reading comprehension, in math, in science and social studies. Just today, I was in a school where every single class in music, in art, in PE, in social studies, in science, every class they're doing nonfiction writing. One of the most powerful things that you can do. And let me just add, for because you are leaders or aspiring leaders, there's a morale issue I want you to think about. Right now, the laser-like focus and the microscope is on the teachers in tested grades and tested subjects. But I don't think that's right or fair when everybody, kindergarten through 12, in every subject, takes on the responsibility for writing at least once a month. Then we all own those ELA scores. And what your kindergarten teachers are doing, even though it doesn't show up on state accountability, is an important ingredient in helping literacy for every other class. Same in math, same in science and social studies. Finally, we got to close the computer and have some human time. There's a wonderful book I would recommend to you by Professor Sherry Turkle, who says we need to close the computer and have human time because kids don't know how to have conversations. Now, it's interesting. Where does Professor Turkle insist that they close the computer? At MIT, where they care a lot about computers. But even at MIT, they know that they've got to close them and have some human time. And I'm worried when I go into classes where kids are interacting more with the screen than with one another. And finally, I want kids to not have to specialize so darn early. Let them explore. Let them be curious. That's what school ought to be about. Next slide. Here is a message. If you are the parent of daughters, we are all teachers of daughters and leaders of daughters, that are the toxic messages our daughters are getting. Number one, good girls get it right the first time. Friends, this starts in kindergarten. Good girls get it right the first time. No, they don't. Good girls make mistakes. Good girls need to be able to have do-overs, just like everybody else does. And when they get the message that good girls get it right the first time, they will never try anything outside of their comfort zone and never take appropriate risks. Well, good girls know that if an A is good or an A-plus is better, that's what Dr. Lisa DeMore called the Hermione Granger effect. Actually, we want them to try things that they're not comfortable with, that they're not good at. My daughter goes to a school where everybody has to do music, whether you think you're good at it or not. Everybody has to do science. Everybody has to do sports. I love the fact that they get kids out of their comfort zone, not just going from A to A plus. Good girls know that if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. Here's the conversation I overheard two girls have. Well, I knew that Annika made a mistake in her essay, but if I told her, it would hurt her feelings, which means that the speaker never learned how to be a good team leader by giving accurate and thoughtful feedback. Annika never got to be a better writer because she wasn't receiving feedback. We've got to make sure that our students can give each other feedback that is not a personal criticism, but is simply a statement of fact. We need a better topic sentence. We need better arguments to support our thesis and so on. And good girls know that you got to be better than a man to do the job. Well, some of you may have felt that way yourself, and I want to really encourage the women of NAESP to aspire to the superintendency and aspire to leadership jobs. It's just plain wrong that only 23% of superintendents are women. But here's why it happens next time you're thinking about a promotion. If there's 10 criteria and a woman meets 8 of the 10, the Harvard Business Review says, she'll say, well, I guess I better work on those other two because I'm not qualified. I only met 8 out of 10. A man meets 2 out of the 10 and says, bring it on. I can learn this on the job. So put yourself out there. Pursue leadership. We need you. Next slide. So the last thing I'll say, and this really applies to the NAESP audience, is an astonishing statistic that said that only 59% of our reading teachers are actually teaching reading correctly. That is, helping students sound out words, the essence of phonemic awareness. Now, I'm all for loving literature, but this nonsense that all you got to do is put a book in the hands of kids and then a miracle happens applies, Daniel Willingham at the University of Virginia says, to 3% of children. 97% need direct, explicit instruction in word sounds, in consonant blends, in vowel sounds, and 59% of reading teachers are doing that, meaning more than 40% are not. And only 22% were using systematic, explicit phonemic instruction. And why? No rap on our teachers. 50% of education professors believe that students can understand text without a grasp of phonics. It's just wrong. It's like they're fighting the 1960s whole language versus phonics wars all over again. Friends, that war has been over for 50 years. So let's have both. Let's have great literature and phonemic awareness and stop the nonsense that it's one or the other. Next slide, please. So I want to stop for a second, and I'll give you about 60 seconds for reflections on research, then we'll get into the meat of today's webinar. You can, as I said, use the chat function, or you can text me. I'll give you about 60 seconds, and then we'll resume.
Natalie shares, I appreciate you sharing that women need to put themselves out there more.
You know, that
Amy says, one small piece that I'm definitely taking back to my fellow educators is the homework concept. I appreciate you addressing that.
And by the way, Amy, if you'd like my article on that, go to creativeleadership.net and you'll see a synthesis of the research on homework. And I include not only Professor Neeson's study, but also my friend Eric Mazur, who teaches at Harvard. And so don't let anybody think that this crusade against homework is just for a low performing school. Eric at Harvard University, where we have relatively bright kids, has stopped doing it as well because he gets more work done during class.
Denise agrees with the research on homework too. Lance mentions we have converted to standards-based reporting, but we're still struggling to see the results we want. Any comments on for him?
That's I really appreciate that. And frankly, I think we overcomplicate the situation. So let me just make two observations. I appreciate standards-based reporting. I've written a few books on the subject, fast grading and elements of grading. However, if your culture and your parents, and most especially your board of education, is fixed on letter grades, please don't think that you're just stuck in the bell curve days. You can have standards-based assessment and standards-based feedback, even with letter grades, because as long as you get rid of the average and you're evaluating students at the end of the semester based on where they are and not the average, that is the essence of what standards-based reporting is about. You're comparing students not to one another and not based upon the average, but to an objective standard. Now, if you want to use standards-based language, that's great, but please don't think that you have to. If you're stuck in an ABCD system, you can still have standards-referenced reporting and assessment. The other thing I want to tell you that from my friend Tom Guskey, who's written extensively about this, is if you're going to use standards-based language, it's okay to use words like meeting standards or proficient. The word, however, that you should not use is exceeds standards. It drives parents crazy. They don't know what it means. It sounds like it's a quantitative distinction. Well, if I meet, that's 5 pages. If I'm exceeding, that's 7 pages. Nonsense. Something beyond the standard, the word I prefer is exemplary, means work that is different in character, in complexity, and rigor. So it's not just about a quantitative difference of exceeding standards. Moreover, you've got to be able to tell me as a student and as a parent, what do I need to do to be exemplary? And exceeds just it remains too much of a mystery. So those are a couple of things I'd watch out for. And I've seen school districts go way off the rails on standards-based reporting, trying to evaluate every standard. Drives the teachers crazy and the parents don't read it. So keep your report down to one page, what I've called not every standard, just the power standards, maybe those half a dozen that are most important, and don't make it such a big burden that people just throw up their hands and quit.
Melanie writes, I have been trying to get my staff to understand the harmful effects of homework for years, but they feel that it is imperative to helping students learn discipline and responsibility. Help.
Well, So here's the honest conversation. I first of all, I deeply respect the fact that your teachers want to teach discipline and responsibility. So good on them for that. And I would give them tons of kudos for their heartfelt desire to instill discipline and responsibility. So the only question before the House is, what's the best way to do that? And if students really were operating independently, being diligent, being organized, and, you know, one of my kids does that. She's wonderful. You can wind her up and homework will get done. But there's a lot of kids that aren't, including some that have the same DNA. So let's not have the illusion that what we think is completed homework really reflects discipline and responsibility. Part of discipline and responsibility means asking for help from the teacher, not phoning a friend and copying homework, not going to the internet and getting answers. It really does mean learning the content. And part of discipline and responsibility is being honest about admitting what I don't know and getting help from the appropriate resource, which is my teacher or, during class, some small group work. So I totally support your teachers and the need for discipline and responsibility. I'm just respectfully saying homework doesn't do that. In class, honest struggles do that. Thanks. Let's proceed then to the meat of today with the next slide. Here are the core competencies of equity and excellence systems. And I'll address these briefly. And then I've also written an article that will help explain some of these as well. As I said, you can find a lot of these on the web. But let's address these core competencies briefly. They're all about leadership, what NAESP is the best in the world at, efficacy. I'm going to define that because I think a lot of people are misusing that term. Focus, few initiatives, not too many. Feedback that's accurate and honest. And finally, effective instruction, what you as administrators are going to be doing. And you are the key person here. I want to say with respect, it's not the state evaluation system. It's not the burdensome paperwork that people are going through to evaluate teachers. Nobody got evaluated into better teaching, but they can get coached into better teaching. And that's the most important thing you as instruction leaders at NAESP will do. So let's take a look at the first one, leadership. Next slide. Here's what Churchill said, stumbling from one failure to the other. And here's the question that I want to ask you. What happened the last time somebody in your leadership, a position, actually made a mistake, admitted it publicly, and did so with great enthusiasm? Next slide. Maya Angelou speaks the truth. And she says she will rise despite every oppressive action that she's been through. That's the level of resilience that if we expect our kids to have it, then we got to model it as well. So I'm asking you as leaders, don't just talk about your successes. Talk about your mistakes. Talk about your failures and talk about them in front of your students. If we want them to be able to bounce back from failure and defeat and learn from them, we want them to be like Maya Angelou and Winston Churchill, able to do that as well. Next slide. Now, I wish that I could say that all of our collaboration looked like this. And that sure feels good to look at it, but sometimes it's more like the next slide. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, that feels good too, but sometimes it's like the next slide where he's saying, actually, my idea of collaboration is doing it without you. So let me just tell you, friends, collaboration is hard work, just like leadership is hard work. So let's talk about some details here. Next slide. We really ask the question, can I make a difference? That is the heart of what efficacy is all about. But I'm worried that for all the discussion and research and rhetoric about efficacy, we're not doing a very good job defining how leaders influence efficacy. So let's take a look at the next slide and address this question. Efficacy has got to be something that addresses the following question. What are the causes of achievement? In fact, let's just do a quick 1 minute exercise right now. Please use the chat function and give me your best answers. You can answer with more than one cause if you'd like, what the causes of student achievement are, and we'll do a quick efficacy test right here live on the video. See you back here in 30 seconds.
Natalie writes feedback. Denise writes effective, well-planned instruction.
Thank you, Denise. Thank you, Natalie. Now, let me ask what you noticed about what your colleagues just said. Effective instruction, effective feedback. Here's one more that came in.
Dwight writes, relationships between staff and students and student engagement.
Yep.
And Amy writes, individual student motivation driven by personalization and involvement.
Okay, so I could not have contrived this to be better. Because normally, if you ask this question to your staff, the answers fall into three categories. Category one, well done. hey, I'm just a potted plant here. It's, you know, they came to school hungry. Parents aren't engaged. Nothing I could do about it. It's all stuff at home. Or the middle category, well, I can't really control it, but I can influence. They're always late. So maybe I'll try some attendance and tardiness policies. Or the third category, stuff I do influence and control. This speaks pretty well of an NAESP audience. Did you notice 100% of the factors that you all just listed together are all things that you influence and control? That's efficacy. Efficacy is not this gauzy feeling about, don't we feel good and don't we make a difference? You sure enough do, but you know, we already knew that. That's why we got in the profession in the first place. So it's not this feel good thing. It's objective observation. And if you do this with your staff, here's how I do it. I have them write a separate cause on a piece of paper. So I'll give them a lot more time than I gave you. You know, maybe 10 minutes, 15 minutes, write all the causes of achievement. And then during a break, I put them up on the wall in those three categories. I didn't tell them in advance what the categories were. I just let them emerge. Then I do the big reveal, stuff I can't control. And there's some of that. I admit that. I can't control access to tobacco, alcohol, drugs, and guns at home. I can't control if they're up at 3 o'clock in the morning checking their likes on Facebook when they're 8 years old. You know, I can't control that. So I admit there's some stuff in that category. But then I look at the middle category, things I influence, maybe can't control but influence. And then the third category, like you did, here are the things that I control and influence. What efficacy is that those last two categories, things I influence and control, are significantly greater than the category of stuff I can't control. And I'd leave those things up on the wall and keep your conversations as a leader focused on those areas where we have influence and control, and stop spending any time in faculty meetings or data meetings or collaborative team meetings or PLC meetings or any other kind of meeting. Stop spending time on stuff that I can't control or influence. It's a waste of your time, and it diminishes your efficacy. So you want to know efficacy in action? That's how you do it. Next slide. So this is perhaps the most important thing for you as leaders, and this is all about focus. And I want to be really precise here, because everybody talks a good game about focus, but a lot of people, when it comes time to actually getting it done, simply don't do it. So I'm going to define focus in very specific terms, and that means if you've got more than six priorities, you might as well have none. I reviewed in the course of this study that I did more than 2,000 school plans. And friends, if you want a cure for insomnia, read 2,000 school plans. It'll cure you right up. And here's the problem. I found individual schools that had 75 priorities. I found a district that had 240 priorities. They might as well have none. They're just playing whack-a-mole all day long. And part of the problem is some of you are laboring under state-mandated plans. It's like Prego spaghetti sauce, whatever somebody can think of. It's in there. It's in the plan. It's in the plan. The plans are 100 pages long, and nobody focuses on anything. So I want you to get focused on a few things. Next slide, please. And somebody like Steve Jobs, who didn't have the greatest diplomatic skills in the world, but I think has built one of the most successful, iconic companies in education or anywhere else around the world, by also understanding that your job as a leader is to say no. So as a leader, everybody's going to come to you with good ideas, and some of them are great ideas. Maybe they'll I want you to all go to the NAESP conference, but here's the problem. Your staff is going to say, oh my gosh, she's going to NAESP. What's Amy going to come back with this time? 100 new things for us to do. So by all means, go to NAESP. Listen to all their great ideas, but don't do 100 of them. Do no more than six. You can't have more than that number of priorities. Next slide, please. So here's how it feels sometimes. Next slide, please. So here is, before I get to feedback, but I want to just say one more word about focus. There's a real difference between what you as leaders think you're focused on and what classroom educators think that they're focused on. In one of the states not represented in this webinar, so I won't tell you who it is, I asked the superintendent, sir, what is your level of focus? And we'll call him Dr. B, Prince Among Men, great guy. He said, Doug, I've read your literature. I know the research. Here's the six items that I'm focused on. I said, yes, sir, but do you mind if I ask your teachers? The teachers listed more than 40 things that they thought he was focused on. So it's not enough to be focused in your own head. You've got to clearly communicate that to the teachers as well. So our next subject is feedback. And when somebody starts a conversation with, gee, honey, I'd like to give you some feedback, it's not going to go well. In fact, I was just reading a wonderful book last week called The Power of Bad. And what it says, probably research that you've heard before, guy by the name of Roy Baumeister, who's a researcher in Florida, said for every negative comment, we got to have five positive ones to make up for it. And too many leaders, maybe I should say too many spouses, think, gee, you know, I messed up, but I'll send her some flowers and that'll get me out of the doghouse. It doesn't work that way. It's 5-1, 5 good for every 1 bad, because people hear that criticism ringing in their ears. And friends, that's true not only for adults, it's really true for students. And sometimes, particularly as they get in the upper elementary grades, all they hear is criticism, criticism, criticism. And then we wonder why they hate school when they go to the upper grades. Next slide, please. So, yeah, that's how feedback feels like. And you, I know you don't intend it that way, but given the rise in teacher evaluation, including punitive evaluation systems around the country, it feels that way from a teacher's perspective. So I'm pleading with you, don't let official evaluation be the centerpiece of how you communicate with teachers. You need to be in there all the time. It's the most important thing you do to give feedback that's accurate and fair and constructive and highly specific. Next slide, please. Now, you might think that this is illustrative of a wonderful classroom. Kids look engaged, enthusiastic, happy. But let me tell you, if you could have another big takeaway from today, it's put the hands down and use equity sticks. And here's why. Equity sticks, as I'm sure everybody knows, means I've got all the students' names written on a stick and I call on them randomly. The rule is you raise a hand to ask a question, never to answer a question. Because when you have this hand raising, like we see in this picture, what that means is that there's kids we don't see who have simply checked out. They simply know that as long as those kids in the front row have got their hands raised, I never have to do anything. And the real pernicious issue here is what happens in mathematics. What happens in mathematics is that we tend to call on the kids who already know the answer. And yet we know that feedback that's accurate and constructive is one of the most powerful tools in the teacher's toolbox. And yet if we don't give accurate and constructive feedback because we're only calling on kids who already know the answer, those kids who are struggling never benefit from our feedback. So I'm pleading with you, put the hands down, use equity sticks. And what I do, I don't want to make this fear-inducing. You can always phone a friend. You can always be able to, if you don't know the answer, I'm not here to embarrass you. Let's ask a friend, or let's take 30 seconds and see if you can have some productive struggle, and I'll come back to you in 30 seconds. But the idea of hand-raising, frankly, is primitive. Speaking of primitive, do you also notice desks are in neat rows like they were 400 years ago, and they probably will 100 years from now? There's way more creative ways we can arrange desks and chairs and tables in a classroom. Next slide, please. Now, one of the things that I want to ask you to do as leaders is really think about the observations you do in classrooms. So I've already raised the issue of equity stacks. But don't stop there. In 10 minutes, you can see if there's evidence of learning. I did some classroom observations today, and I flat told the principal that I did not see evidence of learning. There were a few kids who volunteered, but they asked low-level questions like, everybody with me? Everybody got it? Thumbs up? I was sitting next to one young man who was trying to tell me, and I'm not exaggerating here, that the 22 squared was 7.26 because his calculator told him. And there was really never a check for understanding because he thought he had the right answer and clearly didn't even know how to use the calculator. So I want real evidence of learning and accurate feedback when they do and when they don't have it. I've already mentioned nonfiction writing, one of the most powerful things you can do. Every time you make an observation, make sure that you look in the cabinet, look in those portfolios, see if there's not just writing going on, but and certainly not fill in the blank on these dumb worksheets, but complete sentences and filling out the sort of thing that really reflects thoughtful expressions in writing. But give kids time to reflect. We're so busy talking. A wonderful woman who actually is going to be speaking at our conference this summer, her name is Pooja Agarwal, and I recommend her book, Powerful Teaching, to you. She also has a great blog called retrievalpractice.org. But Pooja says, after about 10 minutes, use an egg timer if you've got to, stop. Let students have 30, 60 seconds to reflect alone, then reflect in a pair, then keep going. Sometimes as a result of standards, we're so pressed to get every bit of content out, we never allow time for reflection. If you're in the classroom for 10 minutes, you ought to see at least some reflection time, not nonstop delivery by the teacher. And I've already mentioned the checks for understanding. And here the other thing that I want to encourage you to do, for goodness sake, don't get a clipboard and stand in the back of the room like you're the inspector. And for goodness sake, don't have some electronic device that I know lots of districts are using to enter in all the details of what you see. Go in there with nothing. Sit next to a student. And I ask these questions. What are we doing? Not a very sophisticated question, but I learn a lot when they can and cannot answer that. And what comes next? Even when kids can tell me what we're doing, very rarely is the answer to what comes next anything more than, well, the teacher will tell me. And you as leaders can fix that. You can have agendas. You can have next steps. When they're waiting around for the teacher to tell me, there's all this downtime. And it's ironic that the number one complaint that teachers have is, I don't have enough time to get everything done. And yet part of that is a self-inflicted wound when they're not using the time with clear next steps that we need in the classroom. Next step, next slide. So here's the last thing I'm going to say, and then I'm going to invite some of your feedback again. Here's the reason that I want you to think in short terms, what we can do in 100 days, literally in this semester. So think about not ending your year in May or June without identifying some short-term successes. One of the things that Teresa Amabile says, she's at the Harvard Business School, and that John Cotter says, is it's fine to think in terms of long-term. As leaders, sometimes you're asked to do these long-term plans, but it depends upon short-term wins. Teachers are tired of these long-term plans that always go the way of the dodo bird. They want to see, what can you do for me? John Hattie says, what can you do in 6 weeks that can have a measurable difference of impact for your students? Moreover, the gold standard practice requires incremental progress. I need to know that I'm getting better and better and better. If I don't know until the end of the year or until state test scores come in, nobody's going to be motivated for that. So I'm making a plea for you for short-term wins. Next slide. Now, what can really be done in 100 days? How about some of Dostoevsky's greatest novels? How about the Constitution of the United States? How about Franklin Roosevelt in the early days of March of 1933, when the country was in the deepest depression and war was looming? In 100 days, he saved this country from what could have been a multi-decade depression and saved the banks and did so many things in 100 days. So I've seen schools literally in the last 12 months reduce failure rates, cut behavior problems in half, literally cut suspensions by 55%, dramatically improve attendance and faculty morale all in 90 days, all in 100 days. So set some short-term goals and then celebrate. I think you should put on your calendar right now the celebrations you want to have at the end of the year. Next slide, please. So the essentials of 100-day leadership really come down to these few things that I've talked about. It's effective leadership, effective instruction, effective focus, no more than 6 priorities, and effective feedback. Last thing I'm going to say, and then I'm going to invite some questions in the few minutes that we have left in the webinar, is if you want a handy way to think about feedback, both for adults and for students, it's the acronym FAST. FAST stands for fair, accurate, specific, and timely. And let's just deconstruct each one of those, and then I want to invite your questions. Fairness is all about consistency. And friends, you got to insist on this. I mean, let's think about the issues of homework and grading policies. Kids talk to each other. Parents talk to each other. And if you've got 3 teachers in the same grade level having 3 different homework and 3 different grading policies, kids know that's not fair. You've pulled some playground duty, I'll bet. So have I. And we've heard the plaintive cry, that's not fair. They have a visceral sense of unfairness is all about inconsistency by adults. And what happens, by the way, in the playground when they think a game is unfair? They stop playing the game. So fairness and feedback is all about consistency. And friends, it applies to adults as well. That's why if you want another good feedback for adult takeaway from today, I'm a big fan of the Kim Marshall rubrics. They are free. You can get them at marshallmemo.com. You don't have to buy anything. And it just allows you to give the same consistent feedback to every teacher, and it allows you to focus on what they need most. Some classroom management, some need help on instruction delivery, some on planning, and so on. So it's got to be fair. It's got to be accurate. So fair, accurate, from the acronym FAST. Accuracy is about grading what I think I'm grading. Why is homework so inaccurate? Because I'm not grading the kids. I'm grading the parents. And who knows, some anonymous internet person that I'm grading as well. Accuracy is about assessing what I think I'm assessing. Some of you serve second language students. This was a big issue for me in my teaching experience. Am I really evaluating mathematics or am I evaluating English language literacy with numbers in it? I need to be super accurate. That's one reason why I think you're on the right track with standards-based grading, because it tends to be more accurate. So fair, accurate, BS is specific. I'll tell you who your models are, and we don't spend enough time in these classrooms. When you're doing observations, start with a music teacher, probably has the largest class size of anybody in your school, and they don't all have gifted musicians in there, but you can hear in a 10 or 15-minute observation, the kids get better. They don't tell them 9 weeks later that they made a wrong note. It's a feedback-rich environment, higher, lower, faster, slower, louder, softer. You see the value of feedback, even with a big class, when you listen to a music teacher. Hey, it's good for your morale, too. Start your day with a music class. Seriously, it's one of the best things that you and I can do. So fair, accurate, specific, the T is timely. We got to have feedback that is absolutely timely, in time to use it. And I grieve that too many of our students, for them, the next report card is a separate geological era. I want them to go home every day with some kind of feedback that lets them know that day by day, I love coming to school because I'm getting better and better. So I want to give you one more shot before we adjourn for the day with questions. And remember, this is a safe and appropriate place for challenges and to represent students or parents or other people who may not be in your room with you. So take a couple of minutes and use the chat function, please, for any final challenges or questions you'd like to share.
As we're waiting for those questions or comments to come in the chat box, Doug, tell us a little bit about, you're coming to our summer conference, right? And we have you down for two sessions. One is on equity and excellence now, the 90-90-90 solution, and then also the 100-day leader, real results right now. So I want to encourage you all. This is kind of like a precursor, it seems like, to your summer conference, right, Doug?
It certainly is, and obviously I'll go into a lot more detail then. But I do want to make one important point that I try to make in this book on achieving equity and excellence. You know, when I started this research, I was focusing on high poverty schools and schools with high numbers of students who were members of ethnic or linguistic minorities. And that's important. But here's one of the things I've learned in the intervening years. These great practices that I was telling you about, that collaborative scoring and about nonfiction writing and so on, that's what you also see in the best schools in the world. You'll see that at the international school in Singapore, where they pay $50,000 a year in tuition. You'll see that at elite New England prep schools. You'll see that at wealthy suburban schools. So don't for a minute think that the ideas that I'm sharing with you are unique to high poverty schools. It's just plain good education. And it's really important that you be a careful consumer and not buy something that says, well, this works for high poverty kids. Baloney. What they deserve is the answer to this question, and maybe this is a good place to tie up our session. What would we do if they were rich? Because if they were rich and if their parents were writing $50,000 tuition checks, they still have trouble reading. But you know what? Nobody says, sink or swim, kid, you should have had that at home. They say, oh my goodness, these parents are spending 50 grand for their education. We'll move heaven and earth to do whatever they need, because after all, that's what rich kids deserve. Rich kids get all kinds of presumptions that everybody's going to succeed. Everybody's going to be great, not because they're any smarter than our kids, but because we just make these positive presumptions about rich kids. And I'm obviously resentful of that. And I think every student that we serve in public education deserves that same presumption that rich students routinely get. So ask that challenging question of your colleague. If we were a wealthy New England prep school, or if we were Singapore International, and people were spending that kind of money, what would we be doing for our students? How would that influence our conversations? I think it's an appropriately challenging question for us to have. Right, so let me just close by number one, thanking you for your time. I respect how dear your time is, especially after a holiday weekend. I also will save this at NAESP. So if you have friends who wanted to see the webinar and are willing to invest 45 minutes in it, please share this with them. And remember also, lots of free resources at creativeleadership.net, where you'll find all the references that I mentioned today, lots of short articles, maybe some good discussion starters. If you're leading a faculty meeting and you want to have a good start, I've got some things, for example, on standards-based grading, just 4 or 5 minutes that'll help get the conversation started. So whether it's video, tools for looking at teaching and leadership, or research articles, they're all free. Please go to creativeleadership.net and take advantage of them.
Again, thank you, everyone. Thank you, Doug, for being here today. And I hope, encourage all of you to come to our summer conference. It's going to be in Louisville, Kentucky. One comment that did come in, I want to make sure we get that. Natalie wrote, I believe that the FAST acronym works for both teachers and students. If we use the FAST acronym as leaders while evaluating and providing feedback, we are modeling how to use the acronym to our teachers, who then can take the same steps with their students. As leaders, we tend to forget to model our expectations for teachers.
Natalie, what a thoughtful point. And if we wouldn't tolerate a student not knowing that they were in trouble until the last day of a semester, then we sure in the world better not sandbag all the comments we've got for a teacher and deliver it in an evaluation conference in May. You need to be providing timely feedback, accurate, specific feedback all year long. Thanks, Natalie, for a great reminder.
As always, if NAESP can assist you in your journey, please feel free to contact us. I hope everyone has a very great afternoon.